Colloquium, colloquium.
You ready? Should we just jump in?
I'm ready. Let's go.
All right. You've been reading a lot lately.
Oh, is that your segue? All right.
I mean, we can ease into it more. So this is, I am drinking LaCroix.
Okay, yes, you are.
Yeah.
Good job.
Start small.
Good job, yeah.
John Paul II is on the microphone.
Yes, he is. Very good. Good stuff. Good guy. Good going. I see that you have acronymed Jordan B. Peterson to JBP.
JBP.
Yes, JBP.
Yes. Do you know what the B's for?
B. No, I don't.
I want to say Brian. Brian feels right.
Yeah, I definitely feel like you needed to give us what that was for after you asked. So,
well, I'm Googling it.
I was Googling it.
The first result just says Jordan B. Peterson. Maybe it is just a B.
Oh, my gosh. Why is the B a thing? Why do people say Jordan B. Peterson?
I think it's like a...
Is it on the front like cover of the book?
Oh, burnt. B-E-R-N-T. Okay. Burnt. Oh. Jordan Burnt.
You know, Peterson. It is on the cover of the book. I didn't realize. Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
I think it's like his publishing name. Okay. But it became like a trope when, like, I remember Logan Cook.
Like
Jordan B. Peterson.
I remember that,
like, he
too,
would always say his name just like that. And so we just would all start saying Jordan B. Peterson.
I feel like there are some people that, like, you feel like you have to say their full name.
Like, this one's obvious why, but Michael B. Jordan.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's another one.
Is his middle name Burnt? This guy was growing up, and everybody's talking about Michael Jordan, you know, the greatest basketball player ever. And he's like, I want to be famous too, man. And his dad probably looked at him and was like, son, you're going to have to use the B in your name.
That's simply not going to work with that B in there.
And so from then on, he was Michael B. Jordan.
Ah, yes, the B version of Michael Jordan. No, I'm just kidding.
Ooh, that hurts.
No, I'm just kidding. He's a great actor.
Nicholas D. Smith.
Indeed.
You might have to do that if you get famous, because, like, Nick Smith is a pretty common name. Yeah.
You know, that is funny. Some people, a lot of people actually feel like when they see me that they have to say my name, Nick Smith, rather than just Nick.
Yeah, you know Nick Smith?
Yeah. Have you found yourself doing that? I don't know. People say that all the time. Like, Nick Smith, not just Nick.
Yeah, you're just a two-name guy.
I'm a big two-name guy.
Like, there's those people. It's like, they're just two-name guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, typically two syllable, like one syllable
each. Yeah, short names. Like, yeah, when it's right. Like a one syllable first and last name, you become a two-name guy. Or down. Like
me and my brother, Zach, we watch pickleball sometimes on TV, and the best player in the world, his name is Ben Johns. So the commentators literally say Ben John. And it's funny because the commentators will enunciate the first syllable, Ben, rather than John's. You know how oftentimes you enunciate the second syllable, Nick Smith. But they say Ben John's instead of Ben John's. It's very confusing. It's funny.
Now stepping up, Ben John's.
That's kind of right, I guess. Yeah. Anyway, but it's another example. Yeah. You don't say John's or Ben. You say Ben John's.
You know, on the homesteading episode of Pines and Aquinas, the guy's name was John Henry Span. But, like, John Henry is a double name, right? And they were talking about that, how he uses the double name. And people will think, like, his first name is John and his last name is Henry.
Yeah.
And that he's just introducing himself as John Henry. So he said one of the things he started doing is he would say, like, he meets somebody, shakes their hand, he'd say, John Henry, it's a double name. Just to, like, clarify.
That's like, good. Yeah.
You want really you good. To call him John Henry, not John, you know, because people would just call him John because they think Henry's his last name. So.
Gotcha, yeah.
Yeah.
Nick Smith, it's a double name.
Oh.
I like that, yeah.
So I have to call you Nick Smith. Yeah.
That's exactly right, yeah. No space.
Anyway.
Okay. So...
Books. You've got a lot of time to read. Are you going to tell us why you've had so much time to read?
You know, I have to say, no, I'm not going to tell you. Anyway. Yeah, so I'm going to the seminary.
You went there. Okay.
Yeah, that's right, I did. Yeah, I'm going to serve as a seminarian for the Diocese of Birmingham in Alabama starting in mid-August. It's now August 4th, so I've got about 2 weeks at home.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. We'll see how it goes.
I've known for a while, so that's why my enthusiasm is a little bit dampened. But right. I am actually very, very excited for you.
Thanks.
So.
Yeah, we'll see. We take it one day at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've been recording a lot this summer because we've had time, and we'll release them throughout the fall and try to stay connected with our listeners a little bit. But probably when you're listening to this, Nick will be in New Orleans.
That's
right. I'll still be up here all by my lonesome doing thing in Huntsville.
That is right. Yeah. But you mentioned the reading thing. I'm going to segue. You know, I've been off. I left my job like at the end of June. Right. So I've been off.
Which is why you've had time to read.
Over a month. You know, but I haven't done as much reading as I would have liked.
Yeah.
Just because I've been busier than I thought I would be. And, you know, that's probably to be expected. There are just various things that come up throughout my day. And I've been on a couple trips. And, you know, I just haven't had the time to read. Or I haven't, at least I haven't made the time intentionally. But I intend to over these next couple weeks. And I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
It's really enriching. And I've found that since I've been like working a desk job for the past 4 or 5 years, I've just lost my ability to concentrate and focus on things. And reading seems to be one of those things that just gets that back a little bit.
Yeah.
That just increases that muscle. Mm-hmm. So I'm feeling the need to, you know, read some more. One, because I enjoy it, and two, because I better start retaining or, you know, re-strengthening that ability to focus and concentrate, because I'm going
to be in
school.
School.
That's right. Yeah. So we'll see.
Yeah. That's wild.
But I've been reading Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. I assume that's where you were going with that.
Yeah. Gosh. Well, yeah, I was trying to bring up both the fact that that's the topic and the fact that we need to tell the listeners that you're going to seminary.
So. You've done good.
Great. Killed two birds with one stone. You've All right. Good. Well, praise be Jesus Christ.
Now I'm forever. I cannot finish it.
But we're not done.
Yes, we're not. Okay.
No, we're not done. We're going to keep going. And talking about JBP, man. I can't believe we haven't done this. Probably because you haven't read them until
Yeah, that's right. I just summer. Pretty much finished like today.
Yeah. So who is Jordan B. Peterson?
A Canadian psychologist.
Good answer.
You're going to have to take it from there.
Yeah, no, that's a good answer. I said psychologist turned cultural commentator. Sounds that's like right. a
That was cool. Like that was really good.
Exciting movie review.
That's good because he's now a big podcaster and obviously author.
Yeah, he's big everything. Works for the Daily Wire now.
Oh, I didn't know that.
For them. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, which this might be too much of a side note. I initially was not happy about that because I felt like Daily Wire is very political and Jordan Peterson's thing was like he's an independent thinker type
was good,
guy. But I think he's done well with the Daily Wire. I think he's still him, which is what matters. So.
Gotcha. Cool.
But yeah, what's he known for? Well, he came on the scene. Most of you have probably heard of him. I don't know how many of our listeners have actually read him. So we'll just kind of give a brief overview and get into what some of his big ideas are. He came onto the scene because, you know, his university in Canada was big on the, you know, you got to call people by the right pronouns thing. And they released a policy that was going to require people, to, you know, use whatever the pronouns the student prefers. And Peterson, you know, he felt strongly about this, that this was a bad policy, not so much out of religious views or strong. He does have strong views about, you know, the gender binary or sex binary, male and female, and has some great thoughts on that. But not so much because of those views as much as he actually is passionate about free speech and the importance of free speech. And this is an idea I've thought more about recently. I've never really thought about till recently in my life, but the importance of being able to disagree and to vocalize ideas. And that he, out of principle, he's a very principled man, and out of principle felt that this policy was a dangerous, dangerous precedent to set in terms of curbing free speech, which then curbs free thought, curbs intellectual progress, curbs all sorts of things that are vital to human flourishing. So he took a stand against this, got canceled, but then ironically also got really popular because people figured out who he was and found out he had some really good things to say.
Yeah, very cool.
He helped many people get their life together. And this is one of the things he talks about. You know, in the midst of all the criticism that he gets, what makes it all worth it, he says, is He says all the time, people come up to him and thank him very emotionally for changing their life, for helping them get their life together.
Yeah.
So he's impacted tons and tons of people, myself included. If I met Jordan Peterson, I'd probably have a similar interaction with him.
Yeah.
Thanking him for the impact he's had on me.
That's good. You know, reading the 12 rules, would it be fair to say that this book is the primary source for these, you know, encounters that people have had with him? Would it be fair to say that? Or do you think there's other media that people have encountered him in?
I would say the book, his speaking engagements, podcast. I think there's a lot of audio content that people listen to from him as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, I will say that, you know, after reading the 12 Rules for Life, which is by far the most interaction I've had with him outside of, you know, just a couple podcasts here and there, I could definitely see the power of just the advice that he gives.
Mm-hmm.
And what strikes me, a couple things strike me, I'll just summarize here, is he is a defender of the authenticity of culture, which I think is really powerful and is relieving, you know, and he recognizes that it's not all good, but he also recognizes that we shouldn't write off the way that our culture has formed us and the way our culture has moved, because those could be very reasonable ways of movement in our culture.
Yeah.
So I think that's really powerful. And then tied to that, his advice oftentimes is very simple.
Yeah.
And like, he gives very logical and intellectual reasons for why he's giving his advice, but it's very simple advice. And we'll get into some other examples, I think, in the 12 rules. But those are a couple things that strike me.
Well, and the 12 rules are like the epitome of that. Like, they're very simple, but there's a lot to them.
That's right.
As well.
Yeah.
So I guess I want to get into a little bit, why is he so influential? Do you have any thoughts on that? Why do you think he's impacted so many people?
I'll just touch on what I just said, is that his advice is simple, and it struck me. And there was one rule that was particularly meaningful for me in my personal life right now, but it's just some of his advice is extremely accessible, and it's relieving. Like, oh, this thing that he's saying, maybe I knew I needed to do it, but I just needed it voiced.
Yeah.
So that's one of those things that I think is really impactful.
Yeah, I think on that, like, it's empowering. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not, I don't know, he stresses a responsibility, right? But not just responsibility in a daunting, like, oh, you have to do all these things sense. But, like, if you take responsibility for your life, you can see some real immediate changes.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really impactful thing, because I think we live in a culture that sometimes goes the opposite extreme and is super sensitive to all the things that hold us back and injustice. And, you know, if only I had this, then my life would be better. And, you know, I'm oppressed, or my group of people is oppressed, and all these things are not wrong. Like, there's all sorts of things. We all struggle with all sorts of stuff and their unfair treatment, and all that's the case. But when we get stuck in that, we aren't getting better.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think he empowers people to say, hey, no, yeah, all that's true. You have a crappy life, right? Things suck for you. But what can you control? Control those things, and you're going to see your life start to improve.
Yeah. That's really good. Yeah.
I think the other thing, too, that makes him influential is something. I mean, you've probably seen his dialogues with Bishop Barron.
I have seen at least one of those,
maybe. So one of the things they've really enjoyed talking about is, you know, the Peterson phenomenon is that he engages Judeo-Christian values and Christian stories, Judeo-Christian stories, like the Hebrew Bible, in a way that is incredibly compelling and captivates a lot of people. And so Bishop Barron is intrigued by this, because he always says to Jordan Peterson, you know, you've managed to do what our pastors aren't doing, captivating people with the Bible, right? And so they've had some good conversations about why that's the case. But that's what makes Peterson, I think, so influential, is he's used the Bible, he's used myth, used traditional values in order to inspire so many people, and in a way that's like outside of any organization or any religion even. Because it's, I mean, it's, you could have a whole podcast on how do you understand his, the faith of Jordan Peterson, because he's, he doesn't really profess to be a Christian, but especially in recent years, has tiptoed more and more into those waters. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, especially from the perspective, like if you're just looking at his books, right? Like not a Christian perspective, but steeped in the Christian tradition and heavily influenced by Judeo-Christian values.
Yep. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, too, you put on here, and I think this is really true, that he's had an impact on young men in particular, and that really resonates with me. I think he has a lot of great things to say that empower men to be men, yeah. Especially in a culture where, you know, feminism seems to be, you know, just, you know, we talked about Barbie last episode, you mm-hmm. know, as being a potential kind of proponent of that, but, you know, how it just seems to, like, feminize men.
Yeah.
Jordan Peterson, I think, is very empowering in that sense. He's like that's the word you used before, and I think that's true. It's just he gives men the permission to be men.
Right. Yeah, and I think for a variety of reasons, not that women don't have their cultural struggles as well, but men, I think, have been particularly whatever the opposite of empowered is, just
disabled,
just kind of not in action, you know, not striving for higher things. You know, I think of like Japan gets cited as just having this culture of like the men just don't do anything. They sit in their basements and they don't want to get married. They don't want to go do anything. It's a generalization, but like I think we see similar trends in the West, like just a lack of desire to do great things,
right?
Which is ironic because like masculinity in a lot of ways is about doing great things and being all that you can.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I think me personally, I think maybe the last thing I'll say on just kind of general why he is so influential, I think he's been influential on me personally. I was introduced to him at a time in my life where I needed to make a lot of changes. You know, I just was coming off a lot of burnout, feeling that like I cannot, like, the difficulties in front of me in life are too great for me to bear, and I just can't bear them, right? And reading Peterson was incredibly empowering for me and allowed me to kind of start doing some little things. One thing that jumps out, and he's less fresh on my mind right now. You just read his book. I've read his book at least once and revisited several the rules from time to time, but it's not fresh on my mind. But one thing that jumps out is he gave advice for people who struggle with like depression. And this is in the book. I don't remember which rule. And he said the first thing he tells every client who struggles with depression is go to bed at the same time. Wake up at the same time every day.
Yeah, wake up at the same time.
You don't have to go to bed at the same time, but wake up at the same time every day and eat a breakfast full of protein. And those are like two things I started striving to do, even just like the breakfast thing. And there's scientific, physiological reasons why those things are good for you. But even just being able to commit myself, it's probably in the make your bed rule. But like, is that even a rule?
No, it's not.
It's not a rule. Yeah, it's a different book. Say make your bed.
Yeah.
But it's along those lines. Like just committing myself to doing those things empowered me to start making other changes in my life that I needed to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good. Really good.
So what are his rules?
Aha, we're going to get into the rules now.
All right.
I see.
Okay, here's the cool thing about the rules. Is the cool but also sometimes frustrating thing is the rules don't direct, like if like I'll tell you the first rule, stand up straight with your shoulders back. That one's more obvious. Let me pick a different one. What is the cat's one?
It's pet a cat when you encounter one on the street.
Pet a cat when you encounter one in the street. That's the last rule. It has nothing to do with cats or petting a cat. And when you read that rule, you can't even really guess what it's about.
Yeah, yeah.
So some of his rules, and then he'll that's the name of the chapter, right, is the rule. And then he goes into this like story that lasts for five pages. And then he goes into like this scientific like psychological like research he's done, and then he ties it into the rule at like the end of the chapter.
Yeah, That's right.
It's like, it's a journey he takes you on, and it can be a little frustrating. But it also is, what's the word? It's not cute. Maybe it's cute. I had a professor who would say that. I don't like the word either, but I had a professor who would say that in describing like certain writing styles. Uh-huh. Like, that's a cute way of saying that. She would say that. I'm like, I would cringe actually when she said that.
It feels very condescending when someone says that to me. Anyway, go.
That's cute. You're cute.
Yeah, you're cute. So, all right, thanks.
Great. I'm like 10. Okay. but anyway, where was I going with that?
You were saying that the rules are not necessarily intuitively titled, and that it can be a little bit of an adventure reading the chapter.
Yeah, and I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that. Yeah. And it's definitely unique to his, you know, you can definitely sense him thinking as he's writing the chapter, you know, which I appreciate. It gets into his mind a little bit.
Well, and that, I guess it's something unique about him is that, you know, it's in a sense a self-help book, right? But it's, you would expect in this kind of a book, the rules to be straightforward, right? And it's like, rule number one is make your bed, wake up at the same, like it's like a practical thing, but it's not. It's like a concept. Mm-hmm. And that concept is going to apply to so many different areas of your life, which allows him to, it allows it to just be more relevant, for one, and not a step-by-step process, but a you need to engage with these concepts because these concepts are going to change your life.
Yep.
So I think it definitely allows him to do more with it. So stand up straight with your shoulders back.
Indeed. I'm trying to do that as we speak.
It's because I slouch. Yeah. What's the point behind it? Obviously the literal meaning of this is don't slouch.
Yeah. Right?
What's the point behind it?
Well, first of all, let me mention that he famously discusses lobsters for like,
this 75%, is the lobster chapter. Okay,
for like 75% of the chapter. He talks about the,
which is cool though.
It's awesome. Yeah. His point is the ancient roots of the dominance hierarchy of, men or, human beings trying to, assert their dominance over other men, human beings, and in the social, ladder or hierarchy.
So it's based off the lobster, right? Yeah. The lobster male lobster fights.
That's right.
In the deep sea. And the one thing that stands out that I always remember from it is that basically if they win the previous fight, they're way more likely to win the next one. And so it's like a confidence thing with lobsters, and obviously with human beings as well, is just building confidence can radically change your life and your chances of success.
Yeah. I think a key distinction there too is carrying oneself with confidence. Because, we're bodily human beings and our bodies say something about who we're becoming interiorly. And he uses the stand up straight with your shoulders back as a way to say, carry yourself with confidence because those are the people who tend to thrive in life. The ones that carry themselves with confidence and therefore are confident. So, again, that's a really meaningful rule, I think.
Yeah.
It's just important because I know that I could use that advice oftentimes. Yeah. So
can we go back to slouching and talk about number two? Or?
Indeed.
Okay, great. I'm still going to try to sit up straight. Wait, do we have to stand? Is that... We need to take it literally. We need to stand for the rest of the podcast, straight with our shoulders.
I think it's understood that I'm kind of the alpha here, so we can just slouch or stand however we want. It's fine. Yeah.
Wait, because you decided?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. All right. Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. You're the alpha, so there's no point
there's no need for you trying to stand. I mean, I'm the only one in here, and we all know I'm the alpha. So.
Yeah, that's fair. All right. Okay. Number two, treat yourself like someone you are responsible for helping.
This is such a... Sorry. You're laughing?
You're laughing at what I'm laughing at?
No.
Okay. I'm laughing at the fact that you put the... No, I typed that, actually. I typed the word life instead of like.
Oh, I did not
see
that.
So I emphasized the K in like as I said it. And then I looked at you and you were laughing too. That's so funny. I laughed.
You spelled life, not like. That's funny.
Yeah. Treat yourself like you're someone you are responsible for helping.
This is really good. really good. And I want to mention, it's very simple, by the way. I probably heard it before, but I want to mention that he mentions at the beginning of the chapter that people are literally better, statistically better, at administering medication to their dogs than to themselves. That to me is wild, and a testament to the fact that we, as you know, we're speaking generally here, people tend to treat themselves like dirt, less than their dogs.
Yeah.
And that's the point he's trying to make here, is that treat yourself better than that.
Yeah, I think the best way of demonstrating this one for me is when you think about, like, we're so good at giving advice to other people sometimes. Like, and sometimes we're very clear at, like, we know what they should do, like, objectively, right?
Yeah.
And then we see them, and it's like, they don't do it, you know? And then I found this helpful when I'm debating a decision, and I'm torn between two things. If I think of myself as, okay, I'm responsible for helping myself, I can then like remove myself from the situation and say, I know what's best for you. There's a clear, like, it may not be easiest, but it's what's best for you and you should do it. And then I go back into my self mode and I can say, oh yeah, like if I were someone I was responsible for helping, like it's clear what I would do.
Right.
So I think it's just a helpful, I think particularly for decision making, is just putting yourself in that situation.
I can't say for sure, but I think this might be where the depression advice is.
I think so too.
Is this rule where he says to, you know, make sure you wake up at the same time and have some protein in the morning. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because I mean, it's true. Obviously, medication, you know, can be a helpful thing for some people, but like there's so much, and this is just what I've found, like, there's so much that you can do with some of these habits, but also diet, exercise, like all that, that can change the way you're feeling.
Yeah,
certainly. Trying to think if there's anything else on that.
I think I'm good here.
All right. We got to get through 12 anyway. So let's go. Yep. 3, make friends with people who want the best for you.
Yeah. This, again, it's just a very like obvious thing to say. Did you want to mention something on this?
I was going to ask if this is the one that, when does he talk about his friend who is like suicidal?
Yeah, he talks about him in multiple chapters, but this is the one where he mentions him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you want to say something about that?
No, tell me if you remember it.
His friend, whom he calls Chris, I assume his name is not really Chris, but sure. He talks about just him. They grew up in the same really small town in Canada, and they, you know, stayed friends over the years. And he talks about how over time, and you know, honestly, when he was younger, his friend just was a negative influence in the sense that he had like a very negative worldview just from very early on, and brought his depressive sort of hostile personality and worldviews into their friendship, and that was just a very toxic thing for him. Mm-hmm. He talks about that some. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that I want to mention in this chapter in particular that struck me when reading it was, he brings in a lot of, you know, statistics and just findings that back up his rules. And one of the things he mentioned was, statistically, even if you hang out in a group of people that are very high functioning and going after what you're going after, and, you know, just good friends, coworkers, whatever it is, even if you have a group of people with just one person who is not up to par, that person, the rule of thumb is, statistically, those people fall to the level of that one person rather than that one person rising to the level of the rest of the group. The person who is subpar actually brings everyone else down statistically. So even if you have a wider group, you let just one person in who doesn't want quote unquote the best for you, that drags you down statistically.
Wow.
So it's really powerful. And I really love how ruthless he is in this chapter. He's just like, listen, you cannot, if you want to thrive, you cannot spend time with people who drag you down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes me think of a lot of things. I think of like toxic friendships. And that was a lesson I had to learn the hard way at times, of like, you know, I've definitely erred, you know, my temperament errs towards the side of just like, be friends with everyone, be nice to everyone, like, et cetera. Right. But I've kind of learned the hard way at times. There are some people, like, some relationships are just toxic, and like, you need boundaries. And at times that will mean like not engaging in a friendship with somebody, because they are weighing you down, or maybe they don't want what's best for you, or yeah, some in some way, in some form of that. So I think also, I think of like the saying that I think is true. You become like the five people you spend the most time with.
Yep.
And does he talk about that?
No, I don't think so. But that's,
yeah,
that's good.
But I never thought about that. Like, what if four of them are great and one of them sucks? Like maybe that is not, like, you're not, you might think you're doing great because you spend time with four really good people, but like that one can really actually make a really negative impact.
Yeah, to be quite honest, and I'm not going to name like the particular example that I'm thinking about, but I can think of it. Like, yes, it is. Yeah, sorry. It's out now. Okay. No, I can think of at least one, maybe two examples in my life of just a friend group whom I've had where we allowed one person to enter into the friend group, and it was extremely toxic, and it made like the relationship of the community as a whole very mm-hmm. awkward, and like just didn't thrive as much because there was this one negative influence.
Yeah.
I have personal examples of that. So, I mean, that resonates with me.
Right. Yeah. And then I guess the other thing I think of is, you know, if you make friends with people who want the best for you, like, you're going to be living in a vibrant community, right? Like, I think it's so tied to community as well, which is, I think, a big theme in both of our lives. Like, if you're surrounding yourself with people who not just like will your good in an abstract way, but like would sacrifice mm-hmm. to see you thrive.
Yeah.
Like that's human flourishing.
Or would tell you what you need to hear. That's a really important part, I think, of being with people who want the best for you.
And that's hard, man. I don't know that I've reached that frequently in my life where, like, I, like, you know, have just a group of people who can just be brutally honest, or vice versa, that, like, I can be brutally honest with. Like, that's, I feel like that's even, like, next level mm-hmm. of, because sometimes it can just, that can actually become toxic too, right, if you're not doing it out of love and if it's not received well.
True. So, yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Numero cuatro, because we got to keep going.
Yes, we do.
Compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today. It's great. This is one that's definitely like self-explanatory, right? It's not about petting a cat, but not really. Yeah. You know, what do we do most of the time? We compare ourselves to others on the internet, right? Which is just unfair to us and to them, right? We have such different lives. And if we're comparing ourselves to who we were yesterday and we're improving marginally on that every day, like, we're going to be way better off than the person we're comparing ourselves to on the internet.
Yeah. And let's be honest, this is a really hard one. Like, I think the advice is very simple and maybe sort of cliched, but I won't lie and say that this is easy. For me in particular, I know this is hard. I'll give you an example of, you know, I would really like to have an artistic hobby that I'm good at.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember a time when me and my brothers got the chance to go to see the statue of David in Florence that Michelangelo mm-hmm. Sculpted. And I was not ready, but it absolutely blew me away. It was one of the most amazing encounters with art that I've ever had. And I thought I was going to go in there and just see some statue and leave, but mm-hmm. it absolutely blew me. My brothers will tell you the same thing. It blew us away. It was absolutely amazing. But the reason why I mentioned that is because you walk up to that statue, and I know my tendency is to see a statue like that or to think about Michelangelo and go, I'm just never going to amount to what this incredible man was able to accomplish in this art form. And so why would I even try to start right now? I'm a 30-year-old man. Why would I even try to start like doing some art? Because mm-hmm. I'm just never going to amount to that or doing anything mm-hmm. worth that. You know, like, why would I even try? Mm-hmm. Which is false and if I believe that in my soul, that would prevent me from doing something really meaningful that the Lord might be asking me to do.
Yeah.
You know, so I think just, especially in our day and age, now that we're exposed to like everyone who's ever painted or drawn or done some form of artistic creation, you know, like the temptation is to see all that and go, you know, my pursuits day in, day out are not worth it.
Right.
And I think it's just really meaningful to reject that.
Yeah. I think of our friend Gilbert Keith, GK Chesterton, indeed. Who, you know, he would say anything that's worth doing is worth doing badly.
Yeah.
And I find that just a consoling, like, cause you and I both have pursued artistic endeavors that, you know, we're not Michelangelo, right? We're not going to be professional artists.
Yeah, it's important to remember too. Sorry to interrupt, but literally no one except Michelangelo is. You know, so like, yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, but that's the thing. It's like, is Michelangelo's art objectively better than yours? Yes. No offense, but you're not even offended when I say that. So no, I didn't even have to say that.
Better, yeah.
But like, I don't know. I think about this, and especially with like conversations I've had recently about AI, it's like AI can do a lot of things that we do, right? AI can generate pictures, probably pictures that are better than something you could draw, right? And you can be deflated by that and compare yourself to AI, I guess. I didn't expect this to go in that direction, but like you can also paint a painting. Like the last two Christmases, I've painted, Emily has led an art, like paint wine and paint night afternoon really, for the faculty. And, I've like given these paintings that I created to my mom for Christmas. And so she hangs it in their house up in Pennsylvania and it's not great, right? It's not great. It's my artwork, but like I did it right. And we can, my mom and I can like rejoice in that. And so I'm glad that I've been able to engage in these artistic endeavors, whether it's that or playing guitar, like that you and me have both dabbled in. You're better than me, or I'm worse than you, rather, I should say, because we're not comparing great to great here. But like dabbling in guitar and doing it badly like is incredibly meaningful to me and brings me a lot of life. And I can see that from the perspective of comparing myself to who I was yesterday. And yesterday, and metaphorically yesterday, really like several years ago, I was someone who couldn't play a chord to save my life on a guitar. So I think it's a really valuable role.
Yeah. I'm reminded too of John Paul II's quote. I'm just paraphrasing. We're called to make of our life a work of art, a masterpiece.
Ooh, I like that.
And I really like that too, just like the continually molding the work of art that is our lives one day at a time. You know, making it more masterful than it was the day before. Seems like a really meaningful way to live.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the next rule, rule number five, I really try to live out with you.
Nice, yeah.
I just don't want you to do anything that makes me dislike you.
That's clever. That's a really clever thing to say. All right.
Thank you. Yeah, but rule five is do not let your children do anything that makes you dislike them. This is a cool rule.
It is. I really like it, actually. I think this one is a little bit controversial. Just because...
Oh, certainly. I think on the surface, it certainly is.
Yeah. I really like this rule. It basically, just maybe to summarize, because it's not immediately intuitive, is like it's the responsibility of the parents to mold their children to be socially capable and acceptable. Which... Yeah, I think it's just really smart, and it needs to be said, even though, like I said before, it's a bit ruthless.
Right. It sounds selfish. It sounds like you don't let your children do anything that makes you dislike them. Like, you shouldn't dislike your children. That's controversial to say that, like, you would even think of disliking your children. But, like, we all do things that are not likable, and some of us do that much more than others. And when you're responsible for raising a human being and teaching them to live in society, if you let them do things that make you dislike them, two things are going to happen. One, you're going to resent them, right? Because they're doing things that make them dislikable. You're going to resent them. It's going to make it harder to be a parent, certainly, when you're resenting your children. Two, you're teaching them that it's okay, it's socially acceptable to do the things that they're doing.
Right.
And they're going to go off into the social environment, and they're not really going to know that what they're doing, because they get away with it at home and people seem to love them anyway. But like you need to help them develop the skills that they need in order to make friends and to thrive in society.
Yeah. Yeah. Just it's a very blunt and simple point, but I think it's just for some reason it's hard to say because we don't want to like step on the personality of a child or whatever. Yeah. But you know, being likable socially is important.
It's period. One of the best things you could be, right?
That's
like,
right.
It's not what makes a saint,
right?
Certainly, but like, it's one of the best things you could do for your children is to help them be likable,
right?
That's going to get them pretty far in life.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is one I certainly plan on taking into parenting. You know, when I have the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, one of the things that I really liked in this rule too is he talks about how he was, I think, getting someone he was babysitting, or maybe it was one of his children. He was trying to, they were having an issue with eating their food, the child, and he was like trying to get that child to eat properly. And he said that like, he just set aside the time to like teach the child how to eat. And one of the things that he was saying was time for children, especially little kids, under the age of 4 is infinitely longer than an adult thinking of time. So
that's
for
true.
Example, 30 minutes is a much longer period of time for a 2-year-old child than it is for a, you know, 40-year-old adult. So spending 30 minutes to like be firm with a child and persistent with a child to eat their food at the dinner table is very possible and worth it to get the child to behave well and according to how they should behave, which I think is just a really meaningful thing to say.
Yeah. Meanwhile, at 27 years old, I would certainly wait 30 minutes to not eat my vegetables.
That's right. Yeah. That's
but 2-year-old? No, that's a long time. That's a long time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Good. This has been part one of our conversation about Jordan B. Peterson. For rules 6 through 12, check out our next episode.